From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is big tech on the defensive? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Google, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon have amassed incomparable power over the U.S. economy, political discourse, and social interactions. Now they're being targeted as monopolies, which determine, intentionally or otherwise, not just what we buy, but how we think. Both the left and the right are now talking regulation. But is big tech insulated by its ubiquitous services, popularity with consumers, and its lobbying power? That's the second half of our program. We'll also update the earthquake damage in Mexico, and we'll hear how Iran's president responded to President Trump at the United Nations. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. In Washington, progressives and conservatives are alarmed by the power of Silicon Valley, suggesting that Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon are monopolies in need of regulation. We'll look at the pros and cons and the political realities. That's the second half of today's program. First, this news update. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani addressed the UN General Assembly today, responding to this critique yesterday of the nuclear deal by President Trump.
Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
President Rouhani said today it's reprehensible that the U.S. has the audacity to preach to peaceful nations about a new model for global interactions cheered by the world. Here's more through a translator.
It will be a great pity if this agreement were to be destroyed by rogue newcomers to the world of politics.
Michael Crowley is senior foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. He joins us from Washington. Good to have you back.
Great to be back, Warren. Thanks.
So, no question, he didn't mention him by name, but it's no question who President Rouhani was talking about as a newcomer to politics.
Absolutely. The Iranians are taking a very defiant attitude toward Donald Trump. Absolutely no interest in a friendly relationship with him, whereas I was at the United Nations General Assembly gathering in, I think it was 2013, when there was talk that Barack Obama might shake the hand of Hassan Rouhani, who at the time was the new Iranian president. And that was the beginning of the nuclear negotiations that led to this deal consummated in July of 2015 that is now at issue so contentiously.
Now, President Trump says he's made a decision about whether to reject the deal. He has a deadline coming up, but he hasn't revealed what his decision is.
That's right. So Trump did say today that he's made his decision. He won't say what it is. He's referring most likely to a deadline that will come up on October 15th, at which point, by law, he has to officially certify whether Iran is honoring the nuclear deal struck by President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, which basically froze its nuclear program in return for relief from economic sanctions. And the United States president has to say, okay, is Iran complying? If Trump says Iran is not complying with the nuclear deal, then a 60-day clock starts during which Congress will debate whether to reimpose the sanctions that were lifted on Iran in return for stopping its nuclear program. Experts say that if Congress were to reimpose the sanctions, that essentially blows up the deal to which many other nations were parties. People need to remember Germany, Great Britain, France, Russia, and China. And many former Obama officials say that this would potentially start us down a path to military confrontation with Iran. Last thing I would just say quickly, international inspectors have been saying repeatedly that Iran is in compliance with the deal, but it's not clear that Trump cares about that. And keep in mind, this may all be a negotiating tactic where Trump may be trying to get the Iranians back to the table by essentially bluffing or trying to intimidate them in the hopes that he might be able to get some kind of a better, tougher deal.
Did the president of Iran give any indication at all that he'd be willing to renegotiate?
Absolutely not. Not the president of Iran, not his foreign minister, Javad Zarif. People may remember that name. Zarif was often at the side of Secretary of State John Kerry. The two men spent hundreds of hours negotiating the nuclear deal together. Up until today, I don't believe Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has even spoken to Zarif. Zarif said yesterday it was a fantasy to imagine that Iran would reopen, renegotiate, or amend the deal. Again, many former Obama administration officials agree. They say you're not going to get anything from Iran now that they were unable to get before, and that trying to do so is going to cause the deal to fall apart, potentially to meaning Iran would restart its nuclear program, potentially putting the U.S. and Israel in the position of contemplating seriously again military action against Iran.
You mentioned all the other nations that are involved in this deal. Does it appear that the international community is on one side or the other?
Absolutely. There's very little support in the international community for undoing this deal. Again, you heard the list of nations that were a party to it. There's a lot of power on the side of maintaining it. None of those countries, not even the Chinese, not even the Russians, countries that often have disputes with the United States, they don't want to revisit the deal. They don't like what Trump is doing. So there's very little sentiment for it. With a notable exception, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was a vociferous critic of the deal during the negotiations and when it was signed. He is essentially goading Trump to try to get the deal somehow toughened or extended in terms of its lifespan. Many conservatives who are hawkish towards Iran think that that's very doable, but there is a wide swath of experts and former Obama administration officials who agree with the Iranian foreign minister that that's basically a fantasy.
Just a few seconds left, but if in fact President Trump were to reject it, if it were go to a vote of the Congress, is it pretty clear how the Congress would vote?
It's actually not. I've talked to some even critics of the Iran deal about this, and they say it's not clear to them. I think there are members of Congress who hate the deal, but they genuinely worry what would happen if the U.S. were the one to blow it up.
Michael Crowley with Politico. Always good to talk with you, and thanks a lot for being with us again.
Always good to be here. Thanks, Warren.
In a moment, the earthquake in Mexico. Will President Trump provide assistance south of the border? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In Mexico City today, responders are still searching for survivors of buildings collapsed by yesterday's massive 7.1 earthquake.
¡Ey! ¡Aquí hay niños! ¡Ayuden! ¡Aquí hay niños! ¡Aquí! ¡Sácalo! ¡Ven, mi amor! ¡Por ahí! ¡No, no! ¡No la vais a raspar!
Dozens of children were killed and more are still missing after the collapse of the Enrique Rebsamen Elementary School. Emily Green is a freelance reporter in Mexico City and she's just outside the school.
I am. There are hundreds of volunteers. People both giving out food, also rescue workers who have been in there, taking away the rubble, and paramedics, also military, and of course, parents. So it's quite a chaotic scene from my vantage point.
Are the parents and relatives being allowed to get closer to the school?
They are, and in fact, I don't have access to them. I think they are being cared for much closer to the school, probably so that reporters like myself don't overwhelm them.
What about the rest of the city that you've been able to see so far and travel through so far? What can you tell us about it?
The city, it seems very much sort of divided. There are parts of the city that seem to have been okay, but other parts that really, including the neighborhood I live in, which is called Condesa, There are simply just buildings that are in rubble, that are dust. When I drove through this morning, I didn't feel safe sleeping at my apartment last night. When I drove through this morning, many streets are cordoned off. There are still rescue workers getting rid of rubble. So it's very much a work in progress. And I think that all of these recovery efforts are going to take weeks, if not months.
You were in the eighth floor of a building last night when it hit, or yesterday when it hit. That's where your apartment is. What was that like?
It was, simply put, terrifying. The apartment started to shake. I think within 5 or 10 seconds, I sprinted downstairs. And I've never had this experience of running downstairs, but you can't because the ground is shaking so much. I was sort of falling all over myself. The glass windows were shattered, and there was glass everywhere, and it felt like pieces of plaster were falling off. And indeed, when I returned to the building today just to check it out, there were a whole piece of plaster missing. And when I got outside, I was in shock, and I was crying because I feared for my life in that moment.
It's extraordinary that you're able to report as you are. Are you going to be able to get back into your apartment?
So I did get back into my apartment today, and it's a disaster zone. I mean, dressers are knocked over, bookshelves are over, all the books splattered everywhere, the TV is over. The kitchen looks like someone came through and smashed every single plate.
There's much talk about the quake that hit just 27 years ago. Are people really mindful of that? Do they remember that? And do they find this even scarier as a result of that coincidence?
Absolutely. It was 95, I think it was 32 years ago. Yes, they find it terrifying, and a lot of people have almost like a post-traumatic stress over it. I talked to one woman yesterday who was absolutely hysterical because in that 1985 quake, her sister had died. And so it brought back all these kinds of memories, and I think that is very much on people's minds here.
You're correct about the casualty figures, and I want to thank you very much for talking to us, as you've been able to do, on your cell phone from the elementary school. Good luck to you, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Correct, not about the casualty figures, but about how many years ago it was that the quake of 1985 struck Mexico City. Daniel Hernandez is a producer and correspondent for Vice News Tonight. He spent a lot of time in Mexico. At the moment, however, he is here in Los Angeles. And Daniel, I know you're talking to people in Mexico City. What we heard from Emily over a rather sketchy cell phone was that apartments have been turned upside down, that people are searching for loved ones. She herself had that terrifying experience. Is that the sort of thing you're hearing from people?
Yes, I'm hearing from a wide array of contacts and people that I got in touch with just out of fear for their safety that there really is still, even today, even this morning, a widespread sense of fear and still shock. No one would have expected that something like 1985 happened again. It's really kind of embedded into the DNA of people who are born and raised in Mexico City. I am not, but I learned very quickly that 85 is kind of a generational marker, and to have something of this magnitude, 1985, happen all over again, were the words someone just said to me moments ago, really is just so shocking. And to have it happen on the anniversary of the 1995 quake just has a kind of cruel and diabolical irony. We're still just kind of heads.
You can update the building standards after a disaster like the one of 1985, but you can't necessarily update the buildings. And I take it that a lot of them are still in the situation they were in 1985, so they're very subject to collapse.
Yes. And my sort of when I think about what's been happening in the past few weeks seismically, you have the major earthquake 8.1 that happened off the coast of Mexico, pretty deep. This one happened closer to the city. People describe the shaking, and seismologists in Mexico have saying that it was kind of more down, similar to the earthquakes we've had here. Those tend to be more destructive as opposed to the side-to-side shaking that I experienced several times over the course of the 9 years that I lived in Mexico. About once a year, we would get, you know, a 6.8 and above kind of quake but nothing ever came down. The rule of thumb would always be, if it didn't fall in 85, then it's never going to fall. Well, that assumptive truth has completely been disproven. I think that there's also, what I'm seeing is that a different range of buildings have been damaged, from colonial churches to very recent constructions, which I think should immediately raise a lot of eyebrows about corner cutting and the kind of bureaucratic corruption that is possible in these kinds of rapid housing developments that are going up all over these major cities.
Does it appear the government's doing any better this year in terms of relief than it did in 1985?
Well, 1985 changed Mexico permanently because the government was completely absent, and the citizens of Mexico City organized their own brigades. Today, in these past few days, the past day, I'm sorry, we've been seeing there has been more of an immediate government response. Military, Marine, and Army have been going out there, but it really still, once again, is civilians leading it. When I turned on my feeds minutes after the quake happened, people were already organizing, men, women, and children, in these rows to try to, by hand, remove rubble. This is something that really breaks my heart, and I think the hearts of a lot of Angelenos who have connections in one way or another to Mexico or to Mexico City, to see this kind of solidarity happen and to see it led again by the students. By students and by teachers and by everyone.
Okay, I think that's pretty much what we heard from Emily Green as well. I want to introduce Leon Krause. He is an award-winning Mexican journalist. He's an author. He's the lead anchor at KMEX, Univision's television station in Los Angeles. And in today's Washington Post, he compares Ronald Reagan's response to the earthquake in 1985 to President Trump's reaction so far to this week's disaster. Leon Krause, good to have you back on our program. You've replaced me a couple of times. We're glad to hear from you.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What do you say about the difference between these two presidents in their reaction to what happened south of the border?
Well, the Trump administration's latest episode of morally reprehensible behavior towards Mexico began actually 10 days ago when a different major earthquake that Daniel just mentioned hit the country, sinking Oaxaca and Chiapas, which are the country's poorest regions, into grief and misery. It took Trump 1 week to reach out to Mexican President Peña Nieto. And just before doing that, Trump explained as a way of an excuse that he just couldn't reach the president of Mexico because cell phone signal was actually bad in the regions where Peña Nieto was, which is absolutely laughable. And I compare it to the reaction of the Reagan administration in 1985. First Lady Nancy Reagan traveled to Mexico's capital less than a week after the earthquake. She walked among the rubble, met with rescuers, with survivors, carried with her a check for $1 million in disaster aid and a letter from President Reagan. And when I went back to the archive and to read what she said, honestly, I found it even touching by today's standards. She says, and I'm quoting, "It was a very emotional experience today. I have tremendous admiration for the Mexican people and what they are doing to help themselves. We are good neighbors and always will be." And the contrast with the Trump administration, Warren, couldn't be more profound.
On the other hand, the Reagan administration wasn't dealing with Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria, which is striking Puerto Rico today.
I agree with you, but a gesture of solidarity does not involve necessarily sending aid, sending money, sending supplies. It just takes heart. And Trump's tweet yesterday, which is, if I remember correctly, 14 words long, just doesn't cut it, in my opinion.
Okay.
Especially if you compare it with what he said about the Emmys, which were apparently much more important just an hour after that.
All right. Obviously, very angry at President Trump. What do you hear from your own relatives and friends in Mexico?
Well, they are shaken. They are of course terribly sad. The result after this earthquake cannot be compared to the calamitous chaos of the 1985 earthquake, which cost the lives of over 12,000 people. But I think that the main question now is what's going to happen. Of course, first with the people who are still there in the rubble, in this particular case in the school in southern Mexico City. I think that's the epicenter center of this unspeakable tragedy. And after that, with the structural damage that many, many buildings have suffered, I think that's going to be the big story. And after the 1995 earthquake, another big story where the people who lost their homes and who stayed in camps for sometimes years on end, that's where the challenge lies and will lie after the next few days of basic, just basic recovery and deep solidarity in Mexico. I think that's a challenge that both the local government and the federal government will face, not only in Mexico City, but other places around the big capital where people also suffered unspeakable, again, damage.
Daniel Hernandez, back to you with Vice News Tonight. We heard Emily Green say earlier from Mexico City that it's going to be weeks or months before the rubble is cleared and people are able to get back into their homes. You were very moved, you said, by the fact that so many people have volunteered to help other people. Elaborate a bit on that. Describe more in more detail what you mean.
Well, people were, when the earthquake struck, transportation was down. So people just began walking home. And from the descriptions that I'm getting, it kind of had that sensation close to the moments when New Yorkers, for example, were walking home out to the outer boroughs after 9/11. A lot of people commute for hours into Mexico City. They had to walk for hours to get back to wherever they live. In addition to that, I heard from a lot of people who just said they just got into this mode and some kind of chip turned on in their brains and they just began collecting whatever supplies they could and just trying to deliver them to the sites of these collapsed buildings. These neighborhoods that were most damaged tend to be the most international friendly, the most tourist friendly. There are a lot of foreigners there. And really, in this kind of a situation, everyone in the city seems to kind of come together. And as a friend just told me, that there's you've seen kind of both the worst side of society and the best side of society. And in a place like Mexico City, those kinds of contrasts can be so stark and immediate. And I think that, you know, these stories that we're going to be hearing, sadly, for the next hours and days, are really going to be a testament to, you know, what we can do as humans, I guess, when a tragedy of this magnitude strikes.
Leon Carras, we think Los Angeles is big, but Mexico City is not just sprawling, but it's also on hills. It's and the population, of course, is enormous. Yeah. I think it's the largest city in the world, if I'm not wrong.
And it was the most improbable of cities, Warren, built on top of a lake, and that's partly what explains what happened to these buildings in that area of Mexico City. We could even go back to the legend of how it was built and how the Aztecs found this place in the middle of a lake, because the prophecy told them that where they found an eagle eating a snake on top of a cactus, that's where they should build their city. And these stubborn people went and built the city there, and now this again, these stubborn people that the Mexicans are just kept building on it, and it's a fascinating, infuriating, wonderful, crazy city that's also incredibly resilient, and it will not only survive but rise from the ashes. I can assure you that. I was 10 years old when the 1985 earthquake hit. My father took me to the rubble of the Tlatelolco buildings, the epicenter of that tragedy, just like the school in Southern Mexico City this time around. And when we drove back, that was the first time I saw my father cry. I will never forget that, but the city rose from the ashes, and my city will rise again.
Leon Carras, again, a journalist, author, lead anchor at KMEX, a Univision station here in Los Angeles. And Daniel Hernandez, you're a journalist, you're a writer. Are you going to try to get down there?
I'm doing the best I can to try and get an assignment. And at the same time, you know, I just moved back to Los Angeles from Mexico City after spending many years covering stuff down there. There's some terrific journalists down there, Mexican journalists, journalists from all over the world who really, okay, once you start covering Mexico, you develop a love for it. And I know that they're doing great work monitoring and seeing how else I can help in any other way.
Daniel Hernandez, thanks a lot for joining us. Thanks again to Leon Carasa and, of course, to Emily Green, who joined us from Mexico City. In a moment, is big tech on the defensive? This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, and I'll be back with To The Point. The political winds in Silicon Valley are shifting. Google, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon are now being described in books and essays as all-powerful, unaccountable, and primed for greater antitrust scrutiny. That's according to Brad Stone of Bloomberg Business Week in a recent article. And Brad, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks.
So who's targeting these massive companies, and how likely is it that they will be in some way brought under control?
Well, I think it's too early to say that anyone is really targeting them. The gears of the antitrust machinery in the U.S. at least have not yet been grinding into motion. You know, certainly Facebook is in the hot seat right now about its acceptance of over $100,000 in ads from Russian sources around the election. But what's happening? I mean, we're feeling this tonal shift around the big tech companies. This kind of discomfort with how big and how powerful they've become, the lack of accountability on topics like, you know, who's buying ads on Google or Facebook. I think, you know, the markets, the industries that they've disrupted are also becoming quite large, and there's a cost, you know, to industries that Amazon can enter with an extremely low cost of capital, with an investor base that seems to be willing to, you know, sustain experiments and losses, and all this is adding up to a tonal shift that these companies, these CEOs looked upon as sort of heroes, as icons, you know, just a year ago today, I think, are a little bit on the defensive.
Well, we have a free market economy. Who are they supposed to be accountable to?
You know, it's a good question, because it gets to the kind of heart of what is so tricky about ultimately maybe regulating these companies. It's, you know, the old theories of antitrust really don't apply. I mean, they're, you know, customers love them. The brand, the loyalty and favorability ratings of these companies are quite high. It's a little different when you go down the list and look at a company like Uber, you know, whose reputation has been tarnished, of course. But when it comes to the big guys, I mean, you know, customers love Apple. They love Amazon. You know, Amazon has over 100 million Prime members around the world. You know, they love Facebook, they love Google, by and large, you know, and yet, like, there are some just difficult questions that are coming up. You know, why does Facebook serve us the news that we see on the social network? And you know, and what are the ramifications of living in a world where you only kind of see news tailored, you know, to you? There are a lot of people who think that one of the outcomes of that was the outcome in the presidential election. What does it mean when prices fluctuate on Amazon? I mean, all these companies, there is a sort of lack of transparency, you know, that has served them quite well. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, if these voices on the left and the right that are saying that these companies need to be held to account, if they kind of come together and form an alliance, and maybe we ultimately do see, you know, we do have a moment where, you know, and who knows what this looks like, but where maybe there's a little bit of enhanced regulation of the Internet.
Left and the right don't agree on much. Do they agree on this, or do they come at it from different directions in different ways?
Well, that's the remarkable thing, right, that this has made for strange bedfellows. And, you know, yeah, there's a populist wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that, you know, that do seem to be somewhat aligned here. Maybe not on the details. We aren't far enough along. But, you know, the House Intelligence Committee has stepped up the criticism of Facebook, and it's very possible in the coming weeks we could see Mark Zuckerberg or another Facebook executive have, you know, testifying on Capitol Hill around the election, and you know, and then you have, you know, voices in the Republican Party, chief among them the President of the United States, has been very vocal in his Twitter account, as he is, in criticizing these companies.
I understand that both Steve Bannon and Bernie Sanders have said that the tech companies should be regulated like utilities. Jonathan Taplin is with us. He's author of Move Fast and Break Things: How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. He's also director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Great to be here.
Do you agree with Steve Bannon and Bernie Sanders, strange bedfellows, if there ever were to?
Well, I think these companies have to be regulated, and we don't need to necessarily start with the most severe penalties of breaking up Google and making them sell YouTube or something, but we could rather start with things as simple as getting Facebook to identify who's buying the ads, the political ads that are on their platform. When you buy an ad on TV or radio, the person who's paying for it has to at least identify themselves. But these, what are called dark ads, which are being used all over Facebook to this very day, are not identified at all where the money has come from. And I would take exception with Brad said about only $100,000 worth of advertising money spent on Facebook. That was only one company that was stupid enough to use its .ru IP address and pay in rubles. Anybody who's smart enough to be associated with the Russian secret services would have hidden their identity and paid in dollars. So my guess is that Facebook has a lot more of what's happening on these in terms of these dark ads than they've led on to date.
Brad Stone, what about it? Are there others who are smarter who have probably given Facebook more than just $100,000 in stupid Russian rubles?
No, Jonathan has a great point. And this is the point, which is that we just don't know, right? And it's a double standard, you know, because if you're a TV station, you know, there are rules around accepting money from overseas sources. There are rules around, you know, you always see at the end of an ad, you know, I'm Joe Biden and I approve this message. And those same rules either don't apply or don't seem to apply on internet advertising. And I think, you know, that might be the first thing that we see in the wake of this last election, that maybe the standards are tightened up and made uniform.
So, Jonathan Taplin, the subtitle of your book, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. We've talked a little bit about democracy, but what do you mean cornered culture? And how is that something that leads to somebody to being accused of antitrust violations?
Well, you think about what happened to both the journalism business and the music business. So the revenues to newspaper advertising have fallen 75% since 2002. The revenues to the music companies have fallen about almost 80% since 2002. So it's not like people aren't watching the news or listening to music anymore. It's just the revenue has been reallocated from the people who make the content, that is journalists, newspapers, everything, to people who control these mass advertising platforms to which is the entry point to which we get to them. So, you know, the LA Times admits that almost 70% of their inbound traffic comes from Facebook. And yet Facebook creams off most of the advertising, and the LA Times is in crisis. And as I travel around the country, they're doing better than the Nashville Tennessean, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, or anybody else. You notice, for instance, that the magazine business is crashing. Jan Winter said they're selling Rolling Stone.
Whoop, we just seem to have lost to Jonathan Taplin. Jan Winter selling Rolling Stone is what I think he was going to say, using that as an example of how it is to once again return to the title of his book that these big companies are cornering culture. Not everybody agrees that there is a big anti-tech wave that's going to sweep very far into the future. One of them is Josh Barrow, a senior editor at Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Good to have you back.
Hey, Warren. Good to be with you.
What about it? You're skeptical about what we've heard from Brad Stone and Jonathan Taplin.
Yes. I mean, first of all, Gallup does polling periodically on the popularity of various industries. And two of the industries that have the most favorable consumer perception are the so-called computer industry and internet industry. People have strongly positive views of these companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon. And I think the reason they have positive views is that these are companies that provide products that by and large work pretty well and that either are free to consumer or are pretty cheap, and the value proposition keeps improving over time. And so I think what that means, if you're trying to say to people that there's some problem of big tech overreach that needs to be reined in, whenever you're proposing any sort of policy initiative, you sort of have two things. One is you need to convince people that there's a problem and get people to agree on what the problem is. And then you need to get people to agree on some proposed solution to the problem. And here, I think it's difficult to even get people to the first step of that, to get people to agree that a problem exists and what it is. I mean, to give an example, we got an announcement a few days ago from Google that the new version of the Google Chrome web browser that will come out next year will prevent autoplay videos from playing sound unless you click on the video and cause it to play sound for you, or you otherwise have agreed that you're interested in hearing sound from it. And people are going to like this because everyone hates autoplay videos. They hate when that thing comes on and they can't figure out what's making noise and how to turn it off. But this is really, in some sense, one of those big tech things Google does, where Google has a big play in the browser industry, and they're using their control of much of the browser industry to affect the way advertising and video and other businesses are done. There are companies that are either publishers or that are Facebook that are putting videos in front of consumers, trying to generate ad revenue by putting those out there, and Google's using its big market power to stop them from doing that.
So are they still going to pay Google then for the advertising if Google turns off the sound?
Well, the advertisers won't pay as much for the videos to be played if the sound won't be played, because what the person buying the advertisement wants is they want the consumer to hear the sound. Google's coming in there and stopping that. But, you know, this is big Google, you know, exerting its control. But this is a thing consumers are going to like. And you see that over and over. When you see the things that are supposedly overreach, it's going to be really hard to convince consumers that those things are actually bad for them. In general, tech is more popular than the other companies that they're disintermediating. People like tech companies better than they like media outlets. They certainly like them better than brick-and-mortar retailers or banks or other industries you might talk about where there's industry concentration. So I think it's not obvious what the big harms to the consumer are, and I think it's really hard to convince consumers that they're being harmed here.
Brad Stone, back to you with Bloomberg Business Week. If you want to see regulation and politicians are involved, certainly it's going to be more difficult to do that if the companies that you're targeting are, in fact, as popular as Josh Barrow says. In fact, if Google can figure out how to get the autoplay to stop, I know a lot of people, including the one sitting here at this microphone, are going to be very happy about that.
That's true. I think that it's one of the reasons why there hasn't been much regulation or any kind of antitrust enforcement in the U.S. And you know, when I talked about a tonal shift at the beginning, I mean I think it's something that's really just beginning and something that's almost new to 2017. But you know, I'll note that you know in Europe the situation's quite different. Marguerite Vestager, the head of the EU's competition council, has you know been on a crusade. It has levied huge fines against Alphabet and Amazon and Facebook, and is quite popular there. You know, that's the beginning. You know, I think that it's interesting. You know, Amazon bought Whole Foods over the summer for what, $13 billion, and it was approved very quickly, right? So, you know, we're still not in an environment where the big moves by the big players are really, you know, scrutinized. But there was something about it when the deal happened that I thought to myself, I wonder if this is the last big deal, you know, that any of these companies, you know, take the risk in making, right? Because at some point, these deals and, you know, antitrust enforcement often gets manifested in the approval or lack thereof of these deals. You know, can you imagine, you know, Google, you know, making a huge acquisition in the U.S. Now or Facebook making a big purchase? I mean, I think these things in this political environment, even if it's not reaching all consumers who I agree with Josh, still do love the tech companies, I just wonder if the big companies will be less likely to make these acquisitions, and if they do, whether they'll be looked at a little bit more closely.
You mentioned Alphabet. That's the name of the company that owns Google, of course. I want to go back to Jonathan Taplin, again, formerly with the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC, an author of a book about all of this. If, in fact, the Europeans are regulating these companies and getting praise for it, does that have something to do with the fact that they're American companies and not European?
No, I don't really believe that. I think, look, the GDPR, which is this new general data privacy regulation, which is going to go into effect in Europe in May of 2018, is an existential threat to Google and Facebook because it basically flips the switch so that everybody has to actually opt in to decide whether to give these companies their data or not. In other words, the default is changed from opt-out to opt-in. So that is a huge shift. And I think the privacy issues, and this is not just in Europe, because Marsha Blackburn has put forth a privacy bill in America that's somewhat mimicking the GDPR.
Member of Congress.
Yeah. And so I think the privacy issues are where it's going. If you want to think about really the outer edges of this, look at China. So Alibaba has deployed something called Sesame Social Credit, which basically takes, and it has 200 million users so far, it takes your credit score and adds on to it all of your social media activity. So if you play video games for 5 hours a day, then your social credit goes down because you're considered a slacker. If you post something that's inimical to the Chinese government, your social credit goes down. If you happen to cross the street in Shanghai and one of those ubiquitous cameras caught you jaywalking, your social credit goes down. Now, what's bizarre is that the Chinese young people are using their social credit scores on the dating apps to say, look, I'm a harmonious citizen, I can do well. All this is doing is enforcing a kind of conformity that to me is incredibly chilling.
All right. Let me go back to Josh Barrow. He said it's very difficult to agree on a problem. What about the problem of privacy? What about when something happens like the Equifax scandal, does that rub off on companies such as Google?
I think consumers' revealed preference is that they don't actually care about privacy concerns that much. To take an example, when Gmail launched about 13 years ago, Google's email application, there was all this concern about that the way Gmail was going to work was that it would look into the text of your messages to serve you ads that were tailored to you. And people were like, oh, that's creepy. It's an invasion of privacy. And what happened? People talked a lot about that, but nobody really cared. Gmail became the market leader because it was a better product. You could search it instantly. It threaded messages. And most importantly, it offered you essentially unlimited storage space, which Google was able to pay for because of the superior advertising revenue they got because of that approach to advertising. So I think, you know, that was an example. People talked a lot about privacy concerns, but ultimately they were mostly concerned about who was going to provide them the best, most convenient product. And they went with that, setting aside the privacy concerns. So I think, you know, I think you're likely to see the same thing going forward in the United States.
Okay. Jonathan Taplin, what do you say to that?
Well, Google eliminated the searching of your Gmail account because, you know, essentially people were complaining about it. So,
okay,
that,
so they eliminated
that no longer
it.
Is the default. So beyond that, look, a lot of people are just beginning to wake up to what these companies actually control in terms of your data. So I had a bioethicist come up to me 2 weeks ago and say, do you know that the iPhone can record the tremors of Parkinson's to an 80% certainty on the same app that records how many steps you took yesterday going up the stairs to your office? Now, that information is just sitting out there in the open. They could sell that to health insurance companies. They could sell it to all sorts of your employer. I'm not sure people want to know that. I'm not sure people understand that their auto insurance rates are not set by how well they drive, but where they drive. So if you drive down to USC every day, and which is considered a more risky neighborhood, you're going to have a higher auto insurance rate.
Well, wasn't that true before we had the Internet and before we had these big companies?
I don't think so, because I don't think the ability of you, you know, I call it surveillance capitalism. That's what these companies do. And as you know, Amazon announced today that it's going to give you a pair of glasses that essentially will be the Alexa on your head everywhere. This notion that you're constantly feeding them more and more data and the ability of these companies to control that data, when you push that forward into the world of artificial intelligence, which these three companies, Amazon, Google, and Facebook, will dominate, I think gets to the place where, as I said, the Sesame Social Credit thing becomes the end state of that.
All right.
It's an episode from Black Mirror.
All right. We have to take a break. We're going to do that. We'll come back, continue this conversation with our current guests, and look forward to that.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To The Point. Are Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon the greatest thing since sliced bread, or are they surveillance capitalists that are leading us toward some sort of control by artificial intelligence? Josh Barrow, you don't buy that. Again, senior business editor, senior editor at Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Are people, once they find out the kind of intrusions that these companies are, in fact, able to conduct into their private lives, even into whether they might have Parkinson's disease, although they might not want anybody to know that. Do you think that might lead, then, to a public reaction that would, in fact, encourage regulation rather than not?
I don't think so, because I don't think that this is a new conversation. I think this is a conversation that we've been having at least as long as the internet has been around. As noted, you know, Google did recently change that process in Gmail, I believe, because it was no longer as central to their business model for Gmail as it was prior. But they had that feature for more than a decade, where a computer would look in your emails and decide what ads to show you, and that did not prevent them from becoming the market leader in that area. So I think, you know, this is something that people will discuss. I think that, you know, certainly things like the Equifax breach increase the salience of it for a time, but then, you know, life moves on from these things and people pay less attention to them. It's always a concern, and it's always something that will matter to some consumers, but I think there's a big difference between the U.S. and Europe here, just a cultural difference, and some of that is a First Amendment difference. Europe has this rule called the right to be forgotten that can force search engines to actually remove results related to matters in your life that are not considered of public interest. Obviously, that's something that would never fly in the United States. You could never have a law that would do that here. And it represents a cultural difference here that I think puts less emphasis on privacy here than is placed in Europe.
Brad Stone, back to you. Bloomberg Business Week. You're in Silicon Valley. Are the companies we're talking about beginning to get nervous about what you referred to at the outset as kind of a new wave of a sentiment, a tonal shift, you said, about them and what they whether they're good or not?
Well, their CEOs and their policy and communications minders probably are nervous, right? At Facebook, they've got to be game planning now their testimony in the coming weeks on Capitol Hill. But, you know, from a business perspective, I mean, there's no greater illustration of the surveillance capitalism economy, as Jonathan dubs it, than these devices, these speakers that people are putting in their homes now that basically listen to what you're saying, like the Amazon Echo. Amazon has sold tens of millions of these devices. Google is followed up with its Google Home device. Apple's coming out with a Siri speaker. They listen to everything you're saying and probably record it deep on some server somewhere. And yet, these are popular devices. So it's funny, we've got a little bit of this friction between, you know, the tonal shift, the policy, the pressure, the public pressure that's being exerted on these companies, but the fact that probably, as Josh says, that people are kind of comfortable with the compromises with their own data they're making as they're signing up for these companies and they're buying devices like the Echo.
These companies are giving new meaning to the term big money. Do you think California politicians, Brad Stone, will guard against them, guard against any regulation of them the way Texas goes to bat for the oil industry?
Well, I don't know. I actually, Warren, I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, we're about to have an interesting case study with Amazon recently announcing a search for its location of a second headquarters. And you know, what we've seen in the week since they've made that announcement is pretty much every state and every city scampering to get on a plane and go hat in hand and tax subsidies in hand to go and beg for this new office and this economic activity that Amazon will be generating in some city in North America when they make their decision early next year. So, I don't know. I mean, I think when it comes to, you know, securing one of these companies for your hometown, the concerns fly out the window, and most states and most cities just want to line up.
So, Jonathan Taplin, if people are buying Echo by the millions, Isn't that sort of even more intrusive than wiretapping? Things hear everything that's being said, whether you're talking in the living room or you're in the kitchen or wherever else you are, and people like it. They buy it. Why are they going to get upset if they think their privacy is being intruded upon?
Well, I mean, you have to use the example of the district attorney in Mississippi who 2 months ago subpoenaed the search logs from the Echo for a domestic violence case, you know, where the husband claimed he didn't try and strangle his wife, and the wife said, well, told the cops, well, check the Echo, and of course there it was. So, I mean, these devices are a lot more intrusive into your home that you know. My sense is that this is a kind of frog boiling in the water kind of situation, that we're going to slowly wake up to think about the effects of this. But deeper into this is the first place that Facebook is going to come into problems is the political election problem. They are definitely going to have to be in front of the Congress, and they know a lot more about Russian meddling in the election than they've let on at all. They know who created the fake accounts. If Facebook eliminated 30,000 fake accounts just before the French election, think about how many fake accounts were in the U.S. Is it the order of 300,000 to 400,000 fake accounts? But they haven't disclosed that yet. They haven't disclosed what the political ads actually were and what kind of voter suppression activity were going. They haven't disclosed what Cambridge Analytica did on their platform. So, I mean, there's a lot more to come on this story, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
All right, Josh Barrow, we know you don't agree with Jonathan Taplin, but you think that there are other industries, we have 30 seconds left, that deserve more scrutiny than big tech. What are they?
Yeah, I think if you ask people, you know, what industries are causing problems in your life, I think people will say hospital systems, pharmaceutical companies that charge too much money, telecom companies that charge too much money and hit you with hidden fees, banks and financial services companies that charge exorbitant fees. There are lots of industries where you can point to people who are providing poor value for money, serving consumers badly, treating workers badly. Those are industries where you can make an argument for the need for reinvigorated antitrust enforcement. I really don't think tech, which is a company that seems to be largely making its customers and its employees satisfied, is a good target.
Okay, Josh Barrow, once again, a senior editor of Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Jonathan Taplin, his book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, Director Emeritus at the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC. Brad Stone with Bloomberg Business Week up in the Silicon Valley area. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Much appreciated. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, live and produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.